call to order the Pacific City Joint Water Sanitary Authority Board of Directors business meeting. It's November 18th, 2025, 5 p.m. We're meeting virtually via Microsoft Teams and in person at the Kiawanda Community Center, Faye Jensen Room in Pacific City, Oregon. The rules of conduct: all cell phones, pagers, and other mobile communication devices must be turned off or silenced. For the duration of the meeting, all persons in attendance will remain quiet during the course of the meeting unless otherwise called upon to comment. Refrain from any behavior that disturbs, disrupts, or otherwise impedes the orderly conduct of the meeting, to include shouting, booing, hissing, etc. Also, refrain from creating, provoking, or participating in any type of disturbance involving unwelcome physical contact. You will be asked to leave the room to conduct side discussions, and you will refrain from any speech of a political nature. So the roll call. Director Strotska.
Here.
Director Anderson.
Here.
Director Shoemaker.
Here.
I'm Director Donahue. I'm the chair. So it is right at 5:01. We'll go now to item four. We'll make a note for the record that Director Dole is not here, and he is not on virtual either. So item 4 minutes. The October 14th, 2025 business meeting. Are there any corrections or additions? Director Strotska.
So I think we discussed this before, but I don't understand the point in having Director Doyle ask a question. Mr. Wesley answered the question. Chair Donahue asked the question. Mr. Wesley answered the question. It doesn't make any sense to me to even include that if we don't tell anything about the question.
Okay. I agree.
So it seems like it should say Director Doyle asked a question regarding blah, 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 and Mr. Wesley answered it.
Under the rules, public meeting rules, as per the manual put out by the Attorney General, you only need to have a general idea of in the minutes of what's going on, but a certain amount of is necessary. I think, and I think Kathy's right.
Well, and we can certainly paraphrase.
Sure. Yeah, it doesn't need to be a paragraph or anything.
But it'd be nice to know what the question was about.
Sure. Yep. No, that certainly seems reasonable to me.
And in this case, it was Director Dole asked, obviously, questions about accounts payable. So,
did you notice something else about the minutes?
Dan had also said when he called Shamra last week that the minutes that you guys got said that the meeting was held at PCJ. Basically, she just copied and pasted over from last week. So she did make that change.
Oh, okay. Okay. Here at PCJ the month before, but not last month.
Right.
Are there any other comments or additions or deletions? If not, I entertain a motion.
I move that the minutes be approved as presented.
I'll second it.
We have a motion and a second to approve the business meeting minutes of October 14th, 2025. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Hearing none. Motion carried. Okay, we'll move on to the financial report, accounts payable for October 15th and October 31st, 31st, 2025. I don't think even I had a comment. Does anybody have any comments about accounts payable?
Dan did have a few questions that I answered. I communicated them with via email about.
Was there anything specific he noticed? Or?
No, he just had some general questions about some of the purchases, just wanting to see what they were. I think one of them was the Northwest Dynavac or whatever it was, or Hydrovac. There was one for Kello Surveying. There was also one regarding the an expense we had related to employee hearing conservation efforts, things of that nature. Just let the board know we are, and this should be reflected in the AP, we are contracting with a company to do a comprehensive authority-wide hearing noise survey. We've never done one. You know, depending on the results of that, it might trigger the need for us to have a OSHA-required employee hearing conservation plan. I don't think we're going to have anything that puts us at that level or qualifies, but we'll know for sure. And if OSHA ever asks, we can say, yes, we have done the survey. And we can even provide the results of the survey, and I think the survey is going to indicate that we do not have to embark on or establish a long-term employee hearing conservation program.
So we have a contractor that's got to do that survey.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think it's got to be 85 decibels, and I think the exposure has to be at least 8 hours a day. Yes. There's going to be times when it's 85 decibels, but it's not going to be anywhere near that long. So
hearing protection's optional. So I mean, they have access to hearing protection.
Oh, and of course they do. And even with our loud areas, we require.
Right.
But you know, if the intensity and the duration was such that it triggered additional requirements from us from an OSHA standpoint, we would certainly comply with those, but I don't think it will.
We have one note here. Dan just joined us.
Oh, good. But that was one of his questions. I think that covered most, if not all of them.
So was one of the questions, I think I may have been, about the software for the locating?
For the actual locator,
right?
Yeah. There was
a couple of big charges, and I think that was for
That was for our new ground penetrating radar system.
Right.
And that's, you'll see two charges in there because it's split between water and sewer
right.
Like always.
And that's what we're doing to get our maps all.
Well, yeah, it'll help with that. The main reason that we went ahead and upgraded our utility locate capabilities, mm-hmm. and this was a major boost in our ability to accurately mm-hmm. locate our utilities, is because we've got fiber optic and a lot of boring work going in community-wide, mm-hmm. and it's going to continue. Let me see if I can mute my mic here.
Right. I thought that's what those two water sewer charges.
It looks like John just joined as well as Tim.
Yeah, we've got feedback. Let me kill my mic if I can. I think. With your mic on and my mic on, Tom, this happens.
Well, let me turn mine off.
Okay.
My mic's off.
Okay. Dan, can you hear us okay?
Dan, can you hear us okay? Yes, I'm still in route to my motel, so this is getting.
Okay, well, as long as you folks attending remotely can hear us, that's the most important thing, and we can hear you, so.
Have you already admitted him?
I'm trying to admit him now.
I admitted him to Mike.
Okay, this one must be close to him.
Okay, he's with us.
Yeah, I'm back.
Tom, your mic is on.
Oh, he got mine off.
Okay. Let me see.
Try that. Okay. Turn my speakers off. John, I did have a question. You were talking about this hearing or sound survey. How much noise is emitted when our emergency generators kick in? Those are pretty good sized machines.
Well, if you're close by, that's gonna breach the 85 decibel threshold.
That's why I thought.
But the good news is other than just exercising the generators and stuff weekly, that is, that's the only amount of time that they are close enough to where it would be a concern.
Can we go back to the microphone thing? Because just because we can't hear you here, Tim and Dan can probably still hear feedback.
Okay.
Well, if we both mute our microphones, then nobody.
One person has to have a microphone on, but you got to pick which one of you it's going to be.
Well, mine's still unmuted. How about yours?
Mine's off.
Okay.
Mine's muted.
Is that what it shows?
That must be frozen. Maybe. I don't know. That shows that you both have your mic on, but maybe it's frozen.
Mine shows it's off.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to close my program because I don't think we need both of these open.
That looks right.
It finally let me into Tim's.
Okay.
Into Teams.
I think we're okay. It's just that's not staying as fast as.
Were there any questions about the accounts payable? Now to entertain a motion for accounts payable for October for the 15th and 31st.
I'll move that we accept the accounts payable reports for October 15th and October 31st, 2025, as reported.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second to approve the minutes for October 15th and October 31st, 2025. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. All five directors. On the financial report, item five, item B, for the general ledger, were there any questions or comments about the general ledger?
I just have one question on the transportation line. It looks like we're already at 50% spent on that.
I don't have it in front of me.
I
will email you about it tomorrow.
I'm just curious why we didn't have that much expenditure already.
Things that go under transportation are going to be fuel, which is always variable. Tires.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I know we got at least one set of tires already. Parts to fix it, belts, things like that.
It just seemed that we were kind of already spending down in that. Mm-hmm. So. Okay. That was the only thing I saw in it.
Okay. Thank you. No other comments. We'll move on to the manager's report. John?
Thank you, Tom. Not a ton this month. Our system development charges, we haven't seen any movement here for a couple of few months. Still, we've got two water and one sewer so far. Did want to circle back to our unaccounted for water numbers. They are creeping in the wrong direction, but as I mentioned in my report. I don't think that's a reflection of any new water leaks that we are currently undiscovered. I think it's just a trick of the math. You know, as you assuming your any water leaks in the system, assuming the unaccounted for water remains the same month to month, well, when you're producing 9 million gallons of water as we do in August, and now we're down to 5 million gallons as we typically are in November, when the production numbers change seasonally like that, the same amount of unaccounted for water is going to change percentages, and it's going to be a bit misleading. So typically these are usually reported as a percentage because people who are calculating these generally compare the percentage to industry standards, which are given in percentages, and trying to meet the current industry standard of 15. By the way, with AWWA, the American Water Works Association, leading the way, they're going to start thinking of the industry standard as being more like 10%. So because of that, I think I'm going to start reporting these numbers as a volume instead of a percentage. Because
volume, you mean what? In gallons?
In gallons. Or in million gallons, hopefully not that high, but in gallons. Because,
Seems like percentage, you know, gave us a quicker picture.
Well, but it can be misleading because you always calculate it as a percentage of the total water produced. And in the summer, if you're producing more than you are in the winter, that's right. Going to change those numbers. Somebody's back there. That's going to change those numbers, even though the amount of actual unaccounted for water could be remain the same.
This is second.
I'm going to kill my Teams program. I don't think it's I don't think having mine open right now is doing us any favors.
Your mic is open.
I can't even get my mouse to work right now.
Mine just dropped off, so now I got it back.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's run with that. I think as long as people can hear hear us from years, Tom, we're in good shape. So, however, if we report those numbers as a volume, you won't get the variability that can be misleading due to seasonal changes in water production.
Are you going to compare it from previous months of what the volume is, so it gives us an idea how we're doing?
Yeah. Well, what I'll do is I'll change the way I report it on the form and that I use to do that, and on the graph as well. Probably I'll wait to do it on the graph until after the first of the year, because then I got to make new charts anyway. So, but I think that would be less misleading and would probably help me too to quantify it instead of just to think of it as a percentage that changes as the math changes. So I just wanted to mention that our generator enclosure project, I'm still making good progress with that. Jump ahead just a little bit here. Early in November, our first two tough shed buildings went in. We've been running into a little bit of delays with our concrete contractor at the third location, which is the 300K. We've got the ground prep done. He's finally got the forms in there, and he's planning to pour that pad early next week. So once that pad is done, we've got to give it 3 weeks of cure time, and then Tough Shed will come and install that third building. We still haven't got any of the electrical work done yet. Our contractor is still trying to obtain the necessary permits from the county. One thing we find time and time again is whether it's a lift station or a reservoir or a well, the county hasn't assigned most of these places an address. Therefore, when we try to pull a permit to do work at these locations, the county's not really sure, you know,
where it is,
or how to identify it.
Yeah.
Hopefully the county, because they struggle with that as much as we do, hopefully they'll begin to realize that, hey, maybe we should assign addresses to these locations.
It seems easy. They could just assign addresses.
Seems like they could just, you know, they could just pick the next number and run with it. So, we should have the electrical permits in place soon, which will enable the electrical work to move forward. I've got most of the parts have arrived for the mechanical side of things, which is mainly dealing with dealing with the exhaust from the generators. So, we're making good progress, and I just wanted to let the board know that. I'll continue to keep you all updated about that. And that's all I've got, Tom.
All righty. Move on to unfinished business.
Well, what wasn't there something else on there about?
I'm going to see this.
On the manager's report?
Yeah.
Oh, it is, but it's a summary
right.
The old business and the new business.
Okay, sorry. I lost my report.
Okay. And Teams here is just dropping off, coming back. I'm having a heck of a time. But that be that as it may. All right, we'll move on to unfinished business. The only thing I wanted to bring up here is we need to make an agenda item for probably right at the first of the year to have a workshop to go over the manager's annual review forum as per some suggestions from our new HR consultant. And Lou Ann said she'd take that on. So if you can kind of work on that, give us an idea, we can call a workshop in January.
Okay.
Give us an idea. Pick who you want to work with you. Okay. That's the only thing I can think of under unfinished business. Move on to new business. John?
Okay. Some in this room have probably heard me talk about this before. I think it's probably, you guys have read the summary I put in the manager's report. Maybe for the good of the meeting, I'll just read what I wrote here because I think it summarizes the issue pretty well. I said I want to bring an issue to the board's attention that has been plaguing the authority for a long time. Back in the year 2000, the authority made the unprecedented decision to require a backflow prevention assembly on every service line at our customers' expense. This controversial and ill-fated decision created such a furor with our customers that the policy was abandoned only a year later. However, approximately 200 of our customers had complied with this requirement by the time the authority had realized their mistake. The state of Oregon was concerned about this local mandate too, so much so that they added a new section to the Oregon administrative rules that govern municipal cross-connection programs. This new regulation, and it truly was known as the Pacific City Rule, requires water suppliers who choose to implement a blanket policy like this to take full responsibility for the annual testing of the installed backflow prevention assemblies. As such, we have been testing scores of privately owned backflow assemblies every year at our expense. In addition, the vast majority of these backflow assemblies have no purpose or need to be there because there are no verifiable cross-connection hazards on the property that would require them. So after 25 years, I believe it's time to put this to a stop. I think we need to shift responsibility for the annual testing of these remaining backflow assemblies to the current property owners. As an alternative, we could authorize the property owners to have these devices removed if there are no cross-connection hazards present. Wanted to mention that this wasn't the first time I brought this proposal to the board of directors. I brought it to the board shortly after I came to work, wanting to do something about it, but at the time, there were some members of the board who were somewhat concerned about it from a PR standpoint. However, this is still something I feel like has got to be resolved. So I want to bring it back, this issue, up to our current board of directors to reassess the merits of this proposal. I think it's time to liberate ourselves from this longstanding burden. This is a complicated issue. I'm sure you all have questions. Before we get too deep into a discussion here, I just wanted to say that how this typically works is a water purveyor will do a cross-connection inspection of a business or a property. And if there are any cross-connections present, and a cross-connection is defined as a potential or actual connection between a potable water source and a non-potable substance or source. If cross-connection or potential cross-connections are found, then typically what happens is the water purveyor requires a backflow assembly on the service line. And water purveyors have the authority to require backflow preventers on the service line. Nowhere else, everywhere on the customer side of the water meter is out of our jurisdiction. That is the Oregon Specialty Plumbing Code. That means that we can't mandate anything on that side of the property line. We cannot, require, and we certainly can't do any plumbing work ourselves. However, we can require a backflow preventer on the service line. That's typically how that works. But the annual testing in nearly every case, these are required to be tested on an annual basis, is at the property owner's expense. It's that way in every 99.9% of the municipalities in the country. It's that way in every municipality in Oregon, except for two of them, both in the Bend area. So the making the responsibility for testing the backflow assemblies has always been the customer's responsibility in this industry. And so that's typically how it's done. And what I'm advocating is even though we required these devices, even without doing any cross-connection inspections, we just made the decision 25 years ago we were going to require one on every service. I think it is time to, I believe it's time to push that responsibility for testing those devices back to the customers. 4 years ago, when I first brought this up, I had discussions with our legal counsel at length about this, and they said that we are, even though of that Pacific City rule, we are able. Oh.
Oh my God.
There's Jeb. That even
you can open the door here.
Terrifying.
Yes. That even with that rule, that we are no longer subject to that rule because it's a policy that we abandoned. And according to our legal counsel, Oregon is not, from a legal standpoint, is not a retroactive state. meaning that we are not bound by old regulation, old rules, old ordinances, or old policies from a legal standpoint, because we have changed those policies. And so if there's any question about the legal ramifications of this or the legal risks or liabilities of this, there are none. So I just wanted to make that clear to everybody. So
the only question I got is, where would this valve be installed at?
Well, and this is the odd thing, is typically backflow assemblies are installed immediately adjacent to the water meter.
That's on the
service
water
line.
On the service line.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Now,
so how can we hold the customer responsible after what you just proposed about being, we can't go into the service or into the line going to the house? It's on private property, you might say. How can you enforce that?
Well, because there are a couple of contradictory concepts related to this. We can require the backflow assembly there. We can authorize it to be removed. What we can't do is we can't install it ourselves. That's illegal. But it has always been the water purveyor's responsibility to manage the testing of the backflow devices in their jurisdiction. And that includes backflow devices that are not only on the customer side of the water meter, but those are backflow assemblies that might be installed in their house.
Right.
So it is up to us, as part of our, you know, the law requires every purveyor to have a cross-connection program, and that cross-connection program hands the responsibility for managing those devices and ensuring they get their annual testing regardless of where they're installed. That responsibility is on the water purveyor.
Okay, one question, you know, in regards to that. On the cross-connection, if everybody's hooked up to city water, where does non-potable water get involved?
Well, for example, if on the property they've got a hot tub with a hard-plugged inlet that is submerged, or if they've got a sprinkler system, or if they've got a residential fire system, or if they've got
anything that's not directly plumbed directly to the kitchen, you might say, right to the beginning of the house?
Well, anything that has a verifiable cross connection, I mean, floor heating systems, that's a cross connection in the eyes of the state. Decorative fountains.
Yeah, all the restaurants have to have backflows if they have carbonated. Yeah.
Pop machines.
Sure.
Ice cream makers, commercial ice machines, kidney dialysis equipment, you know, anything on the property to where, and even in residential properties, there are verifiable cross connections. Anybody that's got a yard sprinkler system, that's a cross connection.
No, I see where that's.
And even though we can't require a backflow preventer at the point of use inside the property, how we handle that is we require it on the service line because it protects our water system from all the hazards on the property or on the premises.
Yeah, I understand that, but I'm really confused on where the cutoff line is. If you say service line and then you say personal property line, if it has to be mounted direct on the service line, all the customers, I'm being kind of both sides here, they're going to say, well, that's your problem, not mine.
What they have to understand, and this is, I understand where you're coming from. I mean, this has been litigated for so many years.
That's going to be the argument of the public.
Yeah, well, if there is a cross-connection hazard on the property, our response, our only legal response as a water purveyor is to require a device on the service line that protects the public water system from the entire property. Now, there are sometimes situations where me as a cross-connection inspector, I'll say, look, you have this hazard on your property. It's either in your house, it's in your yard, who knows.
If they got a sprinkler system up in their yard, there's a problem.
They need backflow protection.
And
often what I will say, and this is what often happens, is I will say, you know, we're going to have to require you to install a backflow assembly on the service line. However, in lieu of that, if you wanted to put a backflow directly at the point of hazard, in lieu of something on the service line, we would accept that because it still protects us from that hazard. The advantage to protecting it at the point of use is not only does it protect the public water system, but it protects everybody in the house. If you put it on the service line, it only protects the public water system, but it doesn't protect the people in the house from the cross connection. So, but it is a bit of a strange concept that, and I'll give you one more. Typically, the water meter is the property line. Backflow assemblies are always installed at directly adjacent to the water meter, but they're always on the customer side of the property. So that's a bit of a contradiction too in the rules, but it's well known and everybody just plays the game.
I can see where it's beneficial for everybody.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, but you know, even a device installed at a hot tub deep into somebody's property is still a device that legally the water purveyor has to manage. They have to make it part of their cross-connection program, and the water purveyor has to ensure it's tested on an annual basis, not by doing the test yourself, but by sending the property owner a letter and saying, okay, a year's gone by. It's time to test your device. Here's a list of, as a convenience, here's a list of certified testers in the area. Please call one of them within the next 30 days to have your device tested. And then once it's tested, the customer gets a copy of the test report, the tester keeps a copy, and the water purveyor gets a copy, and they're required to provide us with a copy within 10 business days.
Do we do that sometimes?
What's that?
Test the device?
All the time.
All the time. Not only do we have devices that we own that rightfully we should test, but the whole point of the conversation is because of this mandate we made 25 years ago, we're testing 120 privately owned devices that probably shouldn't have ever been required. And because of that, for 25 years, we've been testing it because of this rule. What I'm proposing is after 25 years, it's time for us to cut these ties.
So what kind of money are we talking about?
What's it going to cost the customer?
Well, typically, a backflow assembly test might cost them $50. Now, if the test is done and it fails the test, well, then the customer's got to pay to have the device repaired or replaced, and then it has to be tested again to be sure it's in a workable condition.
The question I have is that, looking at what the customers and what the joint water company's got to be responsible for, do we have the resources in-house financially and physical resources to chase that down?
Well, what I can tell you is technically, I guess I can say we do, because we've been doing it for the last 25 years.
I mean, as far as writing all these letters and making each customer comply, because a lot of these people don't even live in Oregon.
And that is sometimes a problem, because if we're testing the device, sometimes we have to wait for somebody to come to town, even if it doesn't adhere to a compliance schedule.
Somebody has to be there when you go.
Somebody often, you know, in many cases has to be there.
Yes.
Sometimes they don't. If it's on the service line, we can just walk up and test it. But we don't send as many letters as we will if we adopt my proposal, because we manage the device, and when it's time to test it, we just send one of our testers over there to test it. We don't send them a letter and say, okay, it's time to test your device. You got 30 days. Please have it done. So that will be one administrative piece that might actually add a little bit of administrative time, but that's the way it's done in every water system in the country.
So if we send someone over there to test it, we're going to charge them for that.
We cannot.
We have, but what you're suggesting is we are?
No, what I'm suggesting is we no longer test privately owned devices. We make the property owner arrange for the test, to pay the tester.
Because we wouldn't be able to test their devices. So the best
thing,
be
the best thing they could do is just put one right at the street, put a backfill right on the street.
Well, if it's needed, but the point being is we're not looking to add new devices. We're looking to either weed out some of these devices that don't have to be there so that nobody has to pay to test them.
Will we take them out if we know that it isn't needed?
We can't do that.
We can authorize the removal, but it's against the law for us to install them or to remove them because they technically...
Well, they were installed by private contractors back in the day.
25 years ago, we asked all our customers to install a backflow preventer on their service line at their expense. And the original intent was to also make them responsible for the testing. However, this is the first time anybody had done this, certainly in the state of Oregon, which is why there was a new rule came out that says, okay, water purveyor, if you're going to require a backflow preventer on a service line on a system that is under the jurisdiction of the Oregon Plumbing Specialty Code and has no known cross-connection hazards, then if you're going to just make that blanket policy, then the water purveyor has to be responsible for the testing, right, whether they test it themselves or whether they hire a tester to do it.
Right.
And we've been complying with that for 25 years, even though this was a policy that was only in place for a single year, and we rescinded that policy in either 2001 or 2002.
And there were about 125 actually put in?
At the time, there were about 200 that went in. We're down to about 125 of them now.
Okay.
9/11 was on 2001, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why they got this idea in the first place.
Well, it's possible.
That way somebody, as a matter of fact, I recall hearing Tony say, good thing we got our backflow system going. When another, I think it was Oceanside water supply was contaminated with something.
Yeah.
So that's what I think out of 9/11, like you say, it was like 2002 this rule came about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, everybody was over cautious.
Well, yeah, you know, they figure
somebody dumped something in the water from their own house.
You know, in my opinion, it was a heavy-handed way to, you know, the idea was noble. You wanted to protect our public water system from any potential hazard. The idea was noble. It's just at the time the implementation of such a rule was unprecedented and very controversial. Still
sounds
is.
Like it was unconstitutional too.
You know, but I will say the rule says you must protect any actual or potential cross connection. If somebody goes to wash their car and they drop their hose into the bucket of suds, that's no longer a potential cross connection. That's a real cross connection.
No, I get it. I understand where you're coming from.
And so, you know, anybody that is any water purveyor that has adopted a policy to do this in modern day, their line of thinking is well, we're just going to err on the side of safety and we're going to protect our system from everything we have no sanitary control over.
Right.
So now I think where this could stir up some renewed controversy is we currently have 120 of these situations. 35 of them were the original owners who will probably remember us requiring them to install this 25 years ago at their expense.
Right.
And now they are going to get a little uptight because 25 years later, we're now going to make them do the testing or remove the device at their expense. But 85 of them are not the original property owners. They did not pay for the devices, although they now own those devices because you know, they The backflow assemblies on service lines are always owned by the business or the customer, and the responsibility for compliance is always the customer or the resident or the business. But the management of it and ensuring everything is done in compliance with Oregon law is the water purveyor's responsibility.
Do we have an idea or a survey of how many we do not need or are not needed?
Well, let me put it this way. Since that one reason we only have 120 left is since I came here, every time we test a device, a privately owned device, and it fails the test, well, now the property owner has to call a plumber to have it repaired because we can't do the repair. And at that point, I say, we send them a letter. We say, look, we came by and did the annual testing of your backflow assembly. It failed the test. You must now call a plumber to have that device either repaired or replaced. And once that's done, we have to go back there a second time to do the follow-up test. But I think I lost track of where I was with your question.
Trying to figure out how many people we can get rid of.
How many, yeah. We can
since every time one of them fails,
yes.
John does contact them and say, hey, or there's a potential that you could have it taken out if you'll let me come over and do a cross-connection inspection.
Yeah. For a courtesy 10-minute cross-connection inspection, I'll come, make sure there's no hazards, and instead of having the customer have to pay for the repair or the replacement, I can authorize them to remove that device at their expense, and then they don't have to worry about it anymore, nor does the authority. And a lot of customers opt for doing that. The problem is sometimes it takes them 6 months to actually follow through with the removal of the device. So slowly I have been weeding these out of the system, which is...
probably takes them several months to get a plumber to even come out.
It could.
So it's not always the customer that's at fault there. They're trying to end it.
Well, yeah, and that is true.
We did basically a survey of plumbers in the area. There's only certain plumbers in the area that will even touch backflows.
Yeah.
So it's not like you can call any plumber.
Right.
You have to call specific ones.
Right.
I noticed there's an awful lot of plumbers from Portland now and Salem and other places.
Well, I would say in the last 2 to 3 months, 10 of these devices have been removed.
Yeah,
but it is a slow, painstaking effort. We have to wait for a device to fail before I can give them an alternate solution that probably would cost the same amount of money.
Right.
And even then, when they say, yeah, I want to do that, I'm going to say, well, I'll give you, try have it done in the next 6 weeks. 6 months later, I go back and check, and it's still there. Yeah. So now that requires a lot of follow-up that I'd rather not do. What I'd rather do is push the annual testing requirement onto the property owner. If it fails, the tester will let them know it failed, and they will probably even better understand the merits of having it removed if they're paying for the annual testing, which is what everybody else does.
I agree with that statement because they're going to feel like you're trying to push them around or tell them what to do.
Yeah.
But if it's on them from the start, they're probably going to follow through with it quicker.
Yeah. I think they would.
If we incorporate this new policy, it's going to take, just for us to understand this, we've been talking about it for 15 minutes.
It's a complex issue.
So you're going to have to figure out a good way to communicate this to our customers.
Well, I have
doing it one by one the way you have been doing and weeding it out slowly. Well, I'm sure they understand it one on one, but to change the policy where it's their responsibility now to have it tested, that means it's an extra expense for them.
Yep.
And
every year
you're going to have to explain it that this is actually it is a necessary expense.
Well, what I will say is when I started down this effort almost 4 years ago, I put together a draft letter to where I indicated, basically, as you may know, you have a backflow preventer on your service line. The way I had it worded or preferred it worded, because it's kind of true after 25 years that The authority has been testing your device as a courtesy for the last 25 years. The authority can no longer, has, you know, the time, the manpower, the money to continue this practice. So we're going to fall into line with what every other water purveyor does. We're going to push the responsibility for the testing on you as the property owner. But in the letter, I will say, however, as an alternative, if you'd allow me to come do a quick non-intrusive inspection, you may be able to avoid the annual testing cost by paying somebody one time to have it removed. I'd rather these devices weren't even there, because if they aren't protecting anything tangible or anything you can verify, then why are we paying all this money and all investing all this time in to protect the water system from hazards that don't exist? So now, Kathy, you know, I did briefly, Kathy stopped by the office for something unrelated. I did briefly bounce a couple of ideas off on Kathy. And Kathy, you suggested, which I think is a good compromise, which is of the 35 customers that were the original customers, that were the customers that received that letter in 2000 from us, these were the customers that complied with our what turned out to be our short-term requirement to install a backflow assembly at their expense, I think those customers are going to be the most sensitive about this, and I think they probably legitimately are justified to be the ones most sensitive about this. The ones that are not the original customers, they didn't spend anything to comply with that regulation 25 years ago. Not only that, they've been the happy recipients of free backflow testing for years and years and years. I think those are the customers that really aren't going to have any moral or intellectual ground to stand on to raise a fuss about this. And that might be a good approach to this, that would get 85 of these off of our annual testing list. We would continue to do the 35. We would monitor those properties, and when they did change hands, we would follow up with them and with one of those, hey, it's tag your it letters. And also in the meantime, if any of those 35, we test it and it fails the test, I can still offer them removal as an alternative. And in many cases, removal could be cheaper than repair or replacement. So maybe that might be a good middle ground, a good measured approach to how we get ourselves out of this mess.
So, John, you know, since we talked, I've been thinking about this a lot, and although I don't disagree that this is a good thing for us to do, I know in the past when we've had public-type meetings, we don't have much of a response, but I think we should give the people that are affected, because it affects their pocketbook, an opportunity to ask questions or provide input.
I'm afraid I know where you're going with this, Kathy.
So, yeah, I would think that not involve the entire community, but to send a letter to those homeowners, set up a meeting and let them come and talk to you. Because I think once you explain that to them well and they can ask questions and you can answer their questions, I think it's going to make it easier for them to swallow. Because I think if you just send them a letter, the authority sends them a letter that says, okay, we're doing this and now it's going to cost you $50 a year, some will say okay and some will not. But if they don't come and they don't, you know, they don't contact you, they don't call, they don't come, then it's on them.
Yeah.
Let me ask one question.
Sure.
Do you know if most of these people we're talking about live full-time here, or are they second homeowners?
It could be either or.
That could be a problem with getting people to respond.
Yeah. It could be either or. I will say I understand Director Staroska's suggestion. To a reasonable person, it sounds reasonable. But I do want to just point out, all we are doing is making what every other backflow assembly owner has been doing all along, not just in our county, not just in our state, not just in our country. This is the way it's been. And I understand, but I've got to also say, most of these people, not being the original homeowners, have also benefited greatly by us assuming the burden financial for doing this. And I will say that after 25 years, we have spent significantly more on the testing and saved them significantly more money on the testing than their initial investment of the backflow assembly was.
And I understand all that.
Yeah, and I agree with that too, except they're going to say, yeah, but I wouldn't even have one if you hadn't told me I had to put one in.
Well, and there is...
it's going to come back to that.
Well, and there is another option that, maybe is worth just a little bit of thought, is we don't have the authority... We have the authority to require them or to authorize them to be removed. We don't have the authority to install them ourselves or remove them ourselves. But another option might be is that we just pay the bill for a plumber to remove these, and we pay the bill to have it removed, if they can be removed. Some of these locations, and most of these are commercial properties, some of these locations may actually have verifiable cross-connection on site, and they cannot remove that device. That device has to stay there by law. And there's undoubtedly a percentage of these where that is the case. But an option would be, if you think about how much you spend testing a device over the course of 25 years versus our expense to pay a plumber just to have it removed, that might be an approach to the problem too that would end this once and for all, would put the financial burden on us to get this done.
One time.
But there is a caveat to that. We can't just unilaterally decide to do that, because these are privately owned backflow preventers, and as crazy it might sound, they may not want to have it removed. But I just want to throw that out there as another example. That would cost us a fair amount of money up front to get this caught up, to clean this mess up, but we wouldn't deal with any of the politics or any of the sensitivities or emotions about this.
Right.
This would be, I would spend the money to pay a plumber to remove these devices, but I can't do that. Number one, I need the property owner's permission to have it removed, because we don't own it. And number two, in order to be even eligible to consider it having it removed, they need to allow me on the property to do a quick cross-connection inspection.
Right.
Because I would be doing the opposite of my job if I removed a device when there was actually a hazard there that it should be protecting.
Right.
So, Kathy, give me some feedback about that potential proposal. And all the board members, for that matter.
I think that although it might cost us some money up front, it'd be money well spent, especially in view of public relations for the community.
Yeah.
I agree. We can't say...
Is there just an option to start with a letter?
Well, if we went down this path, what I would do is I would say, you know, because I can require a cross-connection inspection, and the customer, if they refuse, well, those are the cases where, okay, even though I can't see it, you're going to refuse an inspection. I'm going to require a backflow preventer on your service line.
Right.
That's how we would handle that.
Right.
But in a case like that, I would say, I would probably lead by saying, soon we will be adopting standard procedures that are followed nationwide and pushing the burden of this testing on you every year. However, if you let me come in, and if we don't find any cross-connection hazards, we will pay to have that device removed for you, and you won't have to deal with the annual cost of the testing and any maintenance or repair that might come in the future.
That sounds like a
first off, in a letter, I think, you know, using simple graphics, and I think that can be done fairly easily, exactly what the device does. And, you know, mention out of a multitude of caution during the time that this first started, around 9/11, this is what was a lot of people did, was to prevent a hazard of somebody, a terrorist, putting in somebody's, through their house or their business, poisons that would contaminate our system. But the reality of that actually happened, the percentage is probably very, very small.
Yeah, well, and
we have multiple backflows in our system to protect, that we could isolate a section anyway.
Yeah, and you know, that undoubtedly, just the timing was probably part of the mindset.
I'm absolutely sure it was.
You know, after 9/11, you begin to, I mean, that's when vulnerability assessments began to be a requirement for public water systems. That's when cybersecurity and everything else really started to gain attention. So, I mean, you know, an angle like that would probably be effective, Tom.
On the removal, though, I'm saying, you know, if it can be removed, if I inspect it and it can be removed and that's what you choose, we have to put some kind of a time limit on this, though. I mean, in other words, this can't go on forever. There's got to be,
and one of the
maybe even a...
We have a reporting requirement every year that we have to tell the state how many passed, how many failed, how many got removed.
How many weren't tested,
how many were... Another enforcement activity.
Whatever, right.
The words we use.
Yeah.
Another thing you might consider is offer the possibility of, we know maybe half a dozen plumbers that work in the area, contact them, see if they would be available to do some of this work. We're going to offer your number along with five other competitors to the customer.
Well, that's what we would do if we were going to have the customer remove it at their expense. That's what we would do. You know, if we did it at our expense, I'd call one of these plumbers and say, look, I got a batch deal for you here.
Exactly.
You know,
if
you would, you know, but until I do those cross-connection inspections, it's hard for me to even know where to start or how many to do. Before I forget, I just want to throw out a couple of numbers here. So we have, 45. We've got about 155 to 160 backflow assemblies that we're aware of in our jurisdiction. 120 of these are devices that were installed because of that mandate.
Right.
22 of them were not installed because of that mandate, and therefore they're tested by private testers like everybody else does it.
Right.
We send them a letter, call, here's a list, call somebody, you pay them, you make sure this gets done. And our enforcement is, if they don't comply, we shut off their water.
Yeah.
Right? Just like any enforcement. There are only 20 backflow assemblies in our system that are completely owned by PCJ. These are the only ones that, by any definition, that should be the ones that we test every year, are the ones we own. That's only 20. So on average, testing these privately owned devices, on average, when you combine the admin and the field time, you know, we're looking at about an hour of time per backflow device per year.
Just for testing.
Just for testing and the admin that goes around it. About an hour per device per year. And that includes kind of factoring in those cases where the first test failed and now we got to go back twice. So, and on an average, if you factor in our employees, the tests, our certified tester on staff, their hourly wage, their fringe, the fuel, the wear and tear on the truck, all that, it's on average, it costs us about $50 per device. Takes about 1 hour, on average costs us about $50. For the 120 devices, privately owned devices we're testing, that comes up to an annual cost of $4,250.
And I think you're light on that individual, that $50 is light, I think.
Well, and it could be.
I think you need to add in the fact that we have to get recertified every single year. And we've got, what, three testers?
Yeah.
And that costs almost $400 to $500.
If we were only testing 20 devices, we wouldn't need three testers on staff. And there's a lot of money just into maintaining those certifications. But assuming that the annual, our estimated annual cost for testing these privately owned devices every year was the same going back 25 years, which it wasn't. Wages were lower 25 years ago. But just for simplicity, if the $4,250 we spend on this every year times 25, that would mean to date we've spent over $100,000 on testing other people's backflow preventers. Now, that's not money well spent. And that's not money, that's money that, the money that we use for that, to pay for that, is out of our user fees. That means that there are a lot of people in this town who are paying extra user fees who don't even own a backflow preventer. Mm-hmm. They're subsidizing this craziness we're doing with all these privately owned devices.
So Grandma Jones, who can barely pay her bills, is helping pay for somebody else.
When that somebody should be paying for their own test, especially after this amount of time.
So I think this is, I agree we should do this, but I think it's sort of complicated, and I don't want to put the burden on you, but I will.
That's what I'm here for again.
So if we can table this until the next meeting, and if you could write up something to bring back to us to look at.
Like how would this happen?
A new procedure.
Okay.
Yes.
A new fee schedule, however that would work also.
Well, I think I know what you're asking. I will do that because this is the what. Now we need to know the how, you know. And I'll even put our options. But if it turns out we do like the option of us, hey, this was our dumb mistake 25 years ago. We should pay for our mistake. We got to get ourselves out from under this. If we decide that the best course of action is to pay for the removal of these devices ourselves, this is something we have not budgeted for, and this will, and for 120 devices, that will be expensive. So it would be have to, it might even, if that's the path we wanted to take, before we could launch that, we would probably have to be into a new budget cycle or amend our budget now to be able to move forward.
Yeah, we can amend the budget. That is that we can do that.
Yeah.
That's part of our.
And we could do a certain percentage of them this fiscal year and a certain percentage the next fiscal year so that the financial burden doesn't all fall on us at one time.
Well, and the reality of it is this will be still be a slow process because in order to remove it, I've got to do an inspection. If this is somebody that doesn't even live in town, I got to wait for either to have meet their property manager there or to have wait until they're in town to even coordinate an inspection to even see if it's even prudent for us to pursue removing that backflow preventer.
It's going to be a lengthy process.
It's going to be a lengthy process, but I can tell you this process of waiting for these devices to fail and then calling people up and say, hey, yeah, I mean that, this will be a lengthy process, but that process that we've been doing just simply because we haven't got a cohesive plan for how to approach this has been so slow and so painful. And administratively, you know, very intensive. Very intensive administratively.
Let me ask you this. We've got 20 of our own out there, and we've got 7 water sources. If for some reason we were under attack, I'm thinking of the security side of things. The backflow, the devices we have out there, or the valves we have out there for our sources, could we isolate a major contaminant incident?
Well, what I will tell you is backflow assemblies are useful for the how you get the backflow in an accidental situation. We have a big water leak in the water main. The pressure in the water main drops, and now we're sucking water backward out of people's homes.
Yeah. Right.
That's how this would typically happen in a public water system. And so, you know, the hydraulic conditions have, number one, there's got to be a connection between non-potable and potable. And then you need a hydraulic condition that will force that water to go backwards. Two ways you can do it, back siphonage, like the example I gave, or back pressure. Somebody turned on a pump in the house and overcame the water pressure in our water main and just pushed the water back. That's called back pressure. So those are the two hydraulic conditions that cause this. So everything, you know, in a normal circumstance, everything's got kind of, you know, Murphy's Law has all got to come together. And, you know, and the backflow, that's one reason you got to test backflow every year, is because you don't know when you need them, and they better work when you need them. But what I will say, Tom, those are the situations where backflow preventers are useful. If to stop a intentional attack on our water system, they're not useful, because anybody who's going to go to that extent is, if there was a backflow on the service line, they would just open up the box, unscrew one of the check valves, and pull them out of the device, and then put the caps back on, and now you just have a conduit. So they can, you know, for people that really intentionally want to do something,
they got to know a little bit about the system. They got to know how water works.
And I could give a lot of suggestions for how this could be done, and probably the way it would be done if we were ever under an intentional attack our water system. I don't want to give anybody any ideas, but
have it recorded.
But it would not be hard. And a simple backflow device on the service line is not going to overcome a coordinated effort like that.
And that's why I drink Diet Coke.
Yes. Yes. You know, back in the day, they used to have uncovered finished water reservoirs.
There we go.
I mean, you know, and people had fountains in them, and, you know, they were in parks. Well, uncovered finished water reservoir means it goes through no more treatment. It just goes from the reservoir straight to the distribution system. What would it take for somebody to just walk along and throw a bag of ricin in there? Or whatever, you know?
Exactly.
So coordinated attacks are luckily don't happen very often. Anybody that is determined to do it, this backflow program's not going to stop them.
Okay.
So, well, we've talked about this enough. Do you guys
feel as though you kind of understand the wrinkles and the nuances of this situation a little better? Do you understand why this has been driving me nuts for 4 years? But, you know, I think we can get past this. But I think we've covered a lot of ground tonight. Let's table this to the next meeting. I'll put together some additional things. Be thinking about the options, you guys. One way or the other, this has just got to happen.
Yeah.
And we've got to get past this. And what I would like to do is, during my tenure, I would like to not hand this 25-year-old problem onto my successor.
Right.
So.
Well, and you know, it may take some time to get it all done, but it's doable. Yeah. We can do this.
Yeah. Any last questions about that from anybody? Well, that's all I have in the new business. It'll be unfinished business next month, but we'll continue the conversation. I'll put together some stuff as Kathy. I think I know what you're asking for, and Tom, your suggestions as well. I'll pull that together, and we'll take not cover the same ground, but maybe take a deeper dive into possible solutions and the best way for us to go forth, knowing that, you know, our relationship with our customers is priority number one. So,
all righty, sounds good to me. Well, let's move on to item 9, guest questions and comments. At this time, we have no guests except staff that are here. We'll go on to item 10, chair or director comments. Does anyone have a comment?
So I'm wondering if there's going to be the party girl here. There's going to be a Christmas party for the staff, and if the board's going to be invited.
There will be a Christmas party for the staff, and I think that any board member that wants to come is more than welcome.
Because we came last year. And
yeah. Is it, Rochelle, I know we've already got a sign up. Is it going to be a potluck type of thing?
And, yes.
And do you recall what the date was?
Go look at my calendar. I know it's a Wednesday. It is the 17th.
Pardon?
The 17th.
December 17th.
And it's the lunchtime thing.
From noon to 1 or 11:30 to 1, thereabouts?
Yeah, we usually try to have food ready at noon, so.
Yeah. Okay.
We're cooking at 11:30.
Yeah. No, you guys are welcome, you know.
Okay.
You know, just show up if you guys are free and would like to join us. You guys are always welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Before the next meeting. Week after.
It's the week after our meeting.
Week after.
I can't believe it's almost Thanksgiving.
I can't either.
Yeah.
It's almost Christmas.
It went by really fast.
We've been having too much fun this year. Okay, if there's no other comments, it is now 6:18 p.m. This meeting is adjourned.